the father to carry the separation function is both very, very important in terms of progressive sort of differentiation from the mother rather than forceful opposition. But it rests on something else that I think we in psychoanalysis don't take seriously enough. Peter Plos did when he talked about the isogender attachment, is the father also has to be the attracting object to the little boy, not just the separating object, but the attracting object. The little boy wants to desire the father and the love of the father and the, again, the homoerotic connection with the father, the wrestling with the father or the touching the father's beard, and all the beautiful sensual aspects of the male-to-male relationship that are inherent in that early dyadic father-son relationship.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Michael Diamond. Dr. Diamond is known for many things, but probably he's best recognized as one of the serious thinkers and writers and clinicians in the field of fathering and the paternal function from a psychoanalytic perspective. And that's the focus of our conversation today. It's around his recent book called Masculinity and Its Discontents, The Male Psyche and the Inherent Tensions of Maturing Manhood. We spend a great deal of time talking about cases, talking about masculine development from an early age, the role of the mother, the role of the analyst in being an activator of paternal identifications. It's a fascinating discussion. He has another book coming out in the not-too-distant future called Ruptures in the American Psyche, Containing Destructive Populism in Perilous Times, a phenomena certainly related to masculinity and the failures of mature masculinity. His other books include My Father Before Me, How Fathers and Sons Influence Each Other Throughout Their Lives, and an edited book on the second century of psychoanalysis, Evolving Perspectives on Therapeutic Action. He's received many awards, many teaching awards, which will become obvious when you hear how he shares his thinking on things. He's a training and supervising analyst at the Los Angeles Institute and Society for Psychoanalytic Studies, where he is in private practice. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. Michael, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Harvey. Pleasure to be here.
Michael, it's fair to say that for decades, you have been both a student of and a contributor to the understanding of male psychology. And in your latest book on the subject, Masculinity and Its Discontents, you've really organized your current thinking on the matter. And you've done it in such an analytically alive way. And I say that because there's so much writing nowadays about maleness, about gender in general, but certainly in this case about maleness, that borrows from, if not built on, sociological findings or cultural studies. And your focus is on analytic data. And by that, I mean analytic data that emerges in the transference in your relationship with you and your patients. And that isn't the only source of information we have about the mind, but it is certainly one that's key and opens up new ways of understanding the human condition like nothing else. And I'm grateful for your sharp focus. And your findings have brought you to conceptualize male development in three phases that we're going to spend some time today talking about. It's the prephallic, the phallic, and the genital phase. But you go further than that. You don't only focus on that. You also attend to and are very sensitive to the emotional environment that little boys are raised in. And by that, I mean the unconscious life of the parents. And we're going to spend some time on that as well. And I just want to whet the listener's appetite. I want to read a few sentences from that area of our conversation. And then we'll circle back into those three stages. And this is from a section that's called The Father in the Mother. And you write, "A boy's elaboration of his masculinity and triadic object relations is deficient without a firmly established internal object father carrying the paternal function in the mother's unconscious. The boy's male identification and paternal idealization originate in a relationship with a woman." You go on to say, "Without his mother's, and typically his father's, intersubjective recognition of his maleness, such a boy, rather than internalizing a sense of himself as a sexually mentalizing subject with sexual agency, develops instead a gender identity that is defensively based upon his behavioral activity and physical appearance, and thus is formulated in accordance with being a sex object." There's so much in that that we will get to, but start us off at the beginning about your encounter with these three phases of development.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Harvey. Yeah, I think that maybe the best way to get us set in motion here is to talk about the kind of the waves of theorizing about masculinity within psychoanalysis itself. And it will take us kind of chronologically backwards into the various positions or processes that you're alluding to in terms of the prephallic, the phallic, and the genital. The very first wave of theorizing, of course, was by Freud. And we're all, I think, in the psychoanalytic world pretty familiar with Freud's Oedipal theorizing about masculinity. In particular, the way in which he believed that there was a kind of proto-masculine essence that needs to be achieved through the Oedipal process itself, and that within that proto-masculine essence, which was, of course, formulated during the period where heteronormative ways of thinking about gender and kind of a phallic, you might say, patriarchal orientation towards sexuality and gender was predominant, was part of Freud's original Oedipal theorizing. But what was, of course, lacking at that stage of the theorizing was any sense of what the boy's relationship to the mother, the first object, so to speak, was really about. So a few years went down the road until we get into the mid 20th century, particularly the late 1950s, early 1960s, where a second wave of theorizing about masculinity really took place that was strongly influenced by Margaret Mahler's ideas about the separation individuation process of the child separating from the mother and developing his or her own individualized identity. And that wave of theorizing was really led by two West Coast psychoanalysts, Robert Stoller and Ralph Greenson, and they formulated what came to be known as the disidentification hypothesis, where the idea of the male primary identification is with the mother, so that primary femininity was thought to be essential to the male. Rather than proto-masculinity a la Freud, it was essentially proto-femininity. And the idea then became that for the boy to develop his own sense of maleness, he had to disidentify from the mother and counter-identify with the father. That's kind of where I came into the psychoanalytic world, where I've been exposed to Oedipal thinking and then, of course, disidentification theory. And I found something problematic in the whole disidentification hypothesis. First of all, because I think it was a misnomer to talk about disidentification. I think identifications stay alive in the unconscious of all of us throughout life.
Mm-hmm, sure.
What we do with those identifications can vary considerably. We can have massive defenses against them and so on, but they're there. And so I didn't quite grasp the significance of the idea that a boy has to disidentify from the mother to establish his sense of maleness and counter-identify with the father. In fact, thinking in truly Freudian terms, I thought there were unconscious processes operative right from the get-go, and mother with the boy or with the little girl and so on, that take place. So the disidentification hypothesis, I thought, was problematic and maybe more reflective of difficulties in the triadic relationship between the mother, the father, and the child. So that when there's a forceful repudiation of any kind of identification with the mother, in this case, I thought something was amiss. And it was about at this stage where some very important work was taking place in what I consider to be the third wave of psychoanalytic theorizing about masculinity, some of which took place here in North America with developmentally oriented thinkers. And some took of this thinking took place largely in the continent, in France, where the idea of the unconscious transmission of attitudes, LaPlanche's idea of the enigmatic transmission that took place between the mother and her infant, seemed to have a great deal to do with gender, from my way of thinking. And so in the third wave of psychoanalytic thinking, we kind of go to an earlier pre-separation individuation stage, to the very earliest relationship between the mother and her infant. The area of thinking that I think about and talk about in terms of the primary vulnerability of, in this case, the male infant, where the male is in a helpless position, needing to receive from the mother. And of course, what the infant receives from the mother is not just nurturance in the way of breast milk, for example, but also unconscious transmissions of ideas, attitudes, orientations towards oneself. So in this third wave of thinking and looking at the primary relationship between the mother and the infant, I came to understand how there was always a third involved, because, as you suggested at the beginning, there's always a father that takes place, in, if nothing else, in the mother's mind, even if the father is absent for the little boy or little girl. So there's a third in the mind of the mother, and how that aspect of the mother's unconscious is transmitted to the little boy becomes very important. The father and the mother, as you spoke of earlier. But of course, the mother herself plays a pivotal role too in her attitude about the boy's maleness. So rather than thinking about identification solely in terms of identifying with an other, the way that Greenson and Stoller talked about it, I also think of identification as kind of bimodal, in the sense of it's not just identification with an other as an object, but an identification by the other that gets incorporated or included into the psyche of, in this case, the infant. So how does the mother think about having the little boy? What's transmitted in her unconscious to the infant? And that becomes very much a part of the early foundation for the boy's sense of his relationship to the world outside, and of course, the way in which his sense of himself as a male eventually will become gendered.
I just want to underline your phrasing because it's so succinct, like much of your writing. Instead of being in opposition to mother, that's the disidentification, you suggest instead a progressive differentiation, which is a lovely way to put it. And as you say, it takes energy from both sides. It needs the mother's energy to value her son's autonomy and difference, and also to respect the attachment to the father, either the literal father present or the internal image of the father, and that's an essential bulwark to help manage the upsetness of that separateness from mother. Mm-hmm. As you point out, the connection, the dyadic connection, which Bloss has written so much about, that I'm interested in, because you reference that in the book, and it's always been an important understanding for me, the isogender attachment, the dyadic attachment between son and father. But so tell us a little more about the prephallic and the phallic stages and what it looks like when it shows up in the office.
Mm-hmm. And I choose those terms, you know, an homage to Freud, because the body and the psychosexual instinctual aspects of it are all extremely important. When we're talking about the prephallic stage, we're talking essentially about the oral and anal stages that Freud differentiated for us. And the earliest phase in the development of the infant's relationship and small child's relationship to the body and to the world outside the body. When we're talking about the phallic stage, of course, we're talking about the period in which the little boy begins to discover his sexual difference from the mother and the fact that he has a penis and mommy doesn't. And what does that mean? And how does he incorporate that sense of being different from his primary other? Not only different in terms of generation, but different in terms of gender, which becomes a very significant aspect of what you might think of as the asymmetry in development between the little boy and the little girl. The little girl grows up certainly with an experience of being generationally different than her mother, but of the same gender, the same body. Little boy's body is different than mommy's. Little boy has a peepee and mommy doesn't. Mommy has breasts and little boy doesn't. And how does the little boy incorporate all that? So we'll get into that in a moment. Mm-hmm. In terms of phallic monism and phallic defenses and their adaptive functioning, and at times the very maladaptive way in which phallic defenses operate. But the next stage in development, you know, is what Freud called the genital position. In a moment, I'll make a distinction between stage and position because I think that's very important too. But right now, we're just talking about how we see this evolve, developmentally speaking, chronologically speaking. And the genital stage is a very important achievement for the little boy to be able to achieve, because it's the way in which his phallic propensities begin to become subsumed by something greater than just the ability to thrust and penetrate and have an impact on the world. They're also, the genital stage reflects what the Kleinians would call the depressive position, where there's an awareness of the, or a concern for the object outside the self. So where the phallic position is one where essentially little boy is thrusting and penetrating and trying to have an impact on the world. And of course, his penis then, or his phallus, becomes the symbol of his potency toward the world. In the genital stage, that potency is subsumed by also a desire for connection to an other. So that's the beginning of the maturation and the concern for the object, and of course, subsequent development that will play a very big role in his capacity to have intimate relationships later in life that incorporates both sexuality and affection. So I wanted to say just a moment about I wanted to take a moment to say a little bit about the way I think about these phases in terms of being positions or processes rather than linear states that are subsumed one after another after mm-hmm. another. Because I think in the psyche of the individual male, both childhood, adolescent, and adulthood, and later adulthood, we see oscillating features of these prephallic, phallic, and genital functions or positions, particularly when under threat. We might see a already mature man regress to a more phallic position or even a prephallic position where he's feeling extremely vulnerable, primordially so, and helpless. And then we see defenses that are then relied upon to try to deal with the position that's operative in the psyche. I think of development is constantly involving and oscillating positions of the, for the male, of these gender-related psychic orientations. And the capacity to integrate these positions becomes very paramount in terms of success in life for males.
Similar to the vacillation between the paranoid and the depressive positions.
Exactly.
One always lives back and forth.
Exactly, yes.
Can you tell us about Seth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Seth is a patient that I spoke about quite a bit in my writings over the years, and including in the book.
Yes.
He was a very interesting patient that I learned a lot from, and fortunately was able to help him in a lot of ways. He presented himself as a kind of a, he was a rock musician, and he presented himself as a kind of very cool young man, you know, with a kind of bravado that belied his deeper psychic sense of himself, because he had always felt of himself as a sissy, as he said, and how he struggled with so much of what he considered to be the feminine within himself. He felt a long-time sense of sort of humiliation, profound fear of being shamed. He had a very interesting symptom, which occasionally you see in men. He couldn't urinate in public restrooms and with other men around him. He was also riddled by all kinds of somatic symptoms. When I first saw him, we met face-to-face about three times a week, and I was struck by several things at the beginning. For one, he would kind of obsessively philosophize in the sessions. He was a very bright guy. You know, I would find myself kind of wandering off because it was hard to stay with the material and feel connected to him. And yet something kept me from kind of drifting too far off. And one of the things I noticed was he was always looking at me very carefully to kind of see how I was responding to him. And I began to recognize that what was happening in the transference-countertransference relationship was terribly important, far more important at this stage than the words that were being used and the kind of intellectualizing defenses.
So often the case. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. And I found that I never wandered off too far, even though I didn't find the words very useful to attach to. And I found myself kind of seeing him looking at me very much like, at the time, my very tiny small son would look at me, kind of looking to find himself in me, the way a little boy looks to his father to kind of get his, I would say, his maleness mirrored back to him. You know, there's something about what Peter Bloch talked about as that isogender,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Homoerotic attachment that is so important for the little boy. Jim Herzog writes about it in terms of the father hunger when that's missing for the small boy. And that's basically what I began to understand was taking place in the material. Over time, you know, he would bring in dreams. Dreams would be very interesting. One of the dreams was he was shooting bow and arrows, which sounds like a classical Oedipal sort of dream. But in this bow and arrow arena that he was in, he found me touching his penis, and he was very comforted by it. And in the associations to the dream, he wasn't uncomfortable. He didn't feel, even though he had kind of typical homophobic reactions in the heteronormative culture that we grow up in, most males grow up in, he wasn't threatened by the holding of his penis. In fact, he felt very comforted by it. And, you know, though I made interpretations of the dream at the time, as I recall, that, you know, kind of on the Oedipal side about, well, maybe he wanted to best me in the competition with the bow and arrows or take me out or so on. And it just didn't go anywhere.
Michael, let me ask you a question about that, because that's something I've encountered so often where you, and tell me if I'm understanding what you're describing correctly, you had a sense that his homoerotic attachment to you, as revealed in the dream image, if you're touching his penis, not in a threatening way, but you're in a attentive, loving way, perhaps, it felt, it seems, right to you. It felt as if it spoke to something that was meaningful and vital to him. And yet you felt inclined to go back to a formula. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, well, this must be an aggressively based thing, and I'm sure it's you know, it's a rivalrous thing, and we know that the best way for the rivalrous aspects to genuinely emerge is to attend to these pre-rivalrous aspects and to honor them and to give them shape and words and language and history. And if you do that, don't worry, you'll get to that. Mm-hmm. You'll get to the rivalry, but only if, you know, only if you go at the patient's pace. Now, and yet it's familiar. I certainly know the temptation to, you hear it in case reports all the time. You just said that you did it. How do you understand that pull to the, what you're supposed to, if that's one way to say it?
I was a young psychoanalyst at
perfectly
the time.
Perfectly fair. I get that entirely. I understand. Okay.
That's how. And I didn't trust myself enough at the time to wait. You know, as you see if you read the case, of course, over time, I was able to wait.
And yes, indeed.
The Oedipal conflictual material came out in its
all in good time. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right.
But I had to learn from this case, actually. You know, we write up our cases that we usually learn from, don't we?
And that's true. And hopefully we have good teachers to help us along.
Yes, that's true. That was basically what happened. And
let me read you what you wrote about Seth's case, going back to the authentic experience that you two shared. You wrote, without an available and mature father, both as a flesh and blood actual presence of the same gender and as a symbolic function per se, Seth grew up feeling as if he had been left stranded. He couldn't identify with a healthy man and was at a loss to understand how he could find his maleness in relation to his mother. Mm-hmm. Moreover, his mother's unconscious limitations in recognizing and sanctioning her boy's maleness complicated the loss. Mm-hmm. That's such a rich, I mean, I think we all can feel that person represented by those words, again, in contrast to the formulas that we were taught that have their place, but only when you can listen to writing and descriptions as attuned as you wrote.
Yeah. And, you know, for the benefit of the audience listening, I probably should say a little bit more about the fact that his mother and father divorced when he was about four. His mother was very doting over her son. He was breastfed almost until the age of four. She later was very critical of his dating when he got into teenage years, and also prevented him from learning to drive, which is a huge obstacle growing up in Los Angeles. So you see one side of it. The father, on the other hand, was a very narcissistic, promiscuous guy who would apparently see his son fairly regularly, but would bring him to his apartment when he, the father, was with other women, and they would have sex in the adjoining room, and it would become very disturbing to Seth to hear that. So he didn't have the father who could carry the paternal function very adequately, or symbolic function that could adequately, well, maybe I should make this point now too, that one of the things that's so important for the father is to carry several role functions for the son, one of which is kind of well known in psychoanalysis, which is the separating function, to separate the boy from the mother, not in a forceful oppositional way as this father did, but by being very misogynist towards the mother. And by the way, the mother was very misandrious or critical of men in general. I think she used the expression, men are like assholes with dicks, for example. Mm-hmm. You can see that, you know, gendered ideas about masculinity and femininity are rather perverted in this system. Anyway, I'm suggesting that the father, to carry the separation function, is both very, very important in terms of a progressive sort of differentiation from the mother rather than forceful opposition. But it rests on something else that I think we in psychoanalysis don't take seriously enough. Peter Plos did when he talked about the isogender attachment. Is the father also has to be the attracting object to the little boy, not just the separating object, but the attracting object. The little boy wants to desire the father and the love of the father and the homoerotic connection with the father, the wrestling with the father, or mm-hmm. touching the father's beard, and all the beautiful sensual aspects of the male-to-male relationship that are inherent in that dyadic, early dyadic, father-son relationship. I also bring in a third element that I think is terribly important for the father, and that is to carry the what I call the watchfully protective orientation, where the father can both protect the little boy's development and so on, but also protect the little boy's dyadic relationship with the mother, particularly in the earliest stages where the maternal preoccupation with the infant and small child is predominant for the mother. So in this case,
beautifully put.
Well, I was just going to add with Seth, of course, none of that happened very adequately. And so in the transference to me, you know, I became, of course, a father object who could also be both attracting to him and separating him from his a way of kind of merging with the mother rather than differentiating successfully.
And take what you just said, that you became that father in the transference. I find that thread throughout your book, and you're very quiet and modest about it, but I actually hear it as more revolutionary than you claim. For example, just another quote building upon what you just said. You wrote, "The nature and strength of both the internal father representation and symbolic functioning, in which each remains potentially accessible if awakened, or," you write, "activated perhaps through the analytic relationship." Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite a sentence. Activated perhaps through the analytic relationship. Help us with that. How does an analytic relationship, and connected to that, what's the implications if it's a male analyst or female analyst? How does it get activated in the analytic relationship? What does it look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I'll go back to Seth for a moment. One of the ways it got activated in the analytic relationship is that Seth's, you could say, phallic defenses against his relationship with what culturally gets considered to be the feminine, partly through his identification with his mother, partly through his, what I call his proto-masculine or proto-genital essence, which is misunderstood to be feminine in the culture. Part of that is having it recognized in the analytic relationship as part and parcel of his sense of maleness. Let me be a little more specific. In the case of Seth, for example, he was a musician, and it turned out his mother was a musician herself, played the piano when he was very young. And only late in our work together, probably in the third or fourth year, certainly, probably met over the course of 5 years, was he able to cry, for example. And he had a dream where he was a little boy, and he was watching his mother playing the piano, and he could hear it in the dream. And suddenly he just started to sob and cry because he began to have access to the part of himself that was very much identified with the mother, who could be such a proficient musician herself. And he had so long renounced that part of her in his defensive sort of phallic demeanor. And so what I'm really trying to say more than anything is that there's an inherent receptivity in the male psyche that gets misunderstood as feminine. I think, unfortunately, Freud was confused about this part himself, because he tried to suggest that what was masculine was active and what was feminine was passive. And the whole idea of receptivity would get conflated with passivity. And as a result, a lot of boys grow up thinking that their receptivity is something to be repudiated in some way, as if it were feminine, as if it isn't an inherent part. You know, after all, when I talk about the prephallic stage, I'm talking about the primordial vulnerability, which the survival of the infant rests on his or her ability to be receptive, to take in. And of course, receptivity can have a very active component. It can be, as Abraham talked about it can have a kind of anal, or rather a phallic kind of quality of sadism in the incorporative impulse itself. But it also can, as Bion talks about, have a very active element of sort of what, again, gets written off as feminine, but as a kind of maternal-like metabolizing function. So the receptivity of the little boy from the get-go will eventually, through après-coup, as he gets a little older and becomes part of a cultural code of renouncing the feminine, will become something that the little boy often tends to repress or even dissociate from, that receptivity, which of course will become a very important part of maturing male development. To be receptive to the otherness of the other, to be receptive to one's own dependency and needs and so on. And so we often find in psychoanalytic treatment with men that there's a sense of shame that's associated with needing the analyst's help, with being dependent on an other, because it reactivates in some way that more primordial form of vulnerability that I'm, of course, suggesting that through the analytic process itself can become more accessible and even acceptable to the maturing male.
And can be interfered with, like you're saying, if the analyst and the analytic community misunderstands receptivity as necessarily mothering or feminine.
Exactly.
If it doesn't honor the masculine version of it. Let me read what you write about genitality, which includes receptivity. You say, phallic urges are present and remain significant, but in their genital countenance are transformed into more aim-inhibited and object-recognizing forms. In this respect, there is a strong resemblance between the analytic ideal of the genital character and both the Anglo-Saxon prototype of a gentleman and the Judeo-Hebraic example of a mensch. Mm-hmm. Speaking psychosexually, the maturing man's genital features help him become oriented toward making love rather than simply fucking. Mm-hmm. Though, of course, the impulse to fuck remains an important dimension of his masculinity and lovemaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
You write so
beautifully. I couldn't
have
said it better myself.
Well, you write beautifully. I don't want to let you go before sharing with us your case of Alan, which is also in the book. Because he brings so much of this to light, as well as what happens between the two of you that allows him to live this this genital life, as you described it.
Sure. Well, Alan was a man in entering into midlife, probably in his mid-40s when I first met with him. So a different stage of development, but similar issues may show up. Mm-hmm. For Alan, he came into treatment, as a lot of men do, because he was sort of pushed there by his wife. And he was having a lot of difficulties in the relationship with his wife. He was also a father of two young boys. But he came to me saying, you know, the problem wasn't so much his. It was a problem that he did need some help with, which was how to deal with his wife better. How can you help me, basically, doctor, change my wife? If not change my wife, at least change my way of dealing, not my way of dealing with her, but my feelings about how moody and volatile she seems to be. He had a lot of anxiety and shame about being drawn into his internal world. The first few months of the therapy, well, it was actually an analysis, rather problematic because he was pretty aggressive about, I don't want any of this touchy-feely stuff and these Oedipal theories about mothers and sons and all this kind of stuff. Very bright guy, very successful in his world. Also a very physical man. He was a mountain climber and he had mastered many major peaks in North America and even in Europe. And he was also suffering, as we all do in aging, from some of the limits of his body. And his knees were breaking down, and he just had been in recovery from a knee surgery. And one of the things I recall him saying to me is, I want you to be more like a surgeon with me, you know, knock me out like the surgery and fix it, fix me. He was the only child of a very scholarly professor and a younger immigrant mother who came from Northern Europe. And he had a close relationship with his father and his mother, but his father got ill when he was about 4 or 5 years old. And eventually the father died when the boy was, I think, 7 or 8, following this very debilitating illness. So he watched his father decline, and it was terribly painful for him. He was very insistent on wanting to take after his father and not be like his mother, who he saw as rather flaky. And of course, the analysis often at the earlier stages represented for him, you know, a kind of foray into this maternal flaky world of feelings and dreams and so on. At the same time, he was very close with his mother, and his wife used to criticize him by basically implying that he was too close with his mother. And his very, you know, I'd say narcissistic balance was shaken when she would do that. He was, as I said, very afraid of his inner world of feelings. You could say his inner genital world. And he also was quite critical of his younger son, who was very artistic and may have been proto-gay even. But the patient, Alan, himself was kind of put off by this younger son, but very drawn to his older son, who was very athletic and very physical, and he could relate to him in those ways. So much of the early treatment was, you know, my bearing his kind of defensive, phallic defenses, you could say, to not let me penetrate, to not let me get inside him too closely. And I, you know, could endure that, of course, and survive that. And as over time, he gradually became a little bit more trusting of me, and he then talked to me about his having seen the film Field of Dreams, which, as many, I'm sure, listeners will remember, it was a powerful
yes.
father-son drama of a boy seeking to recover a father that he never fully had, the father hunger in the dream, rather in the film. Was profound. And so Alan saw the film, and he came into a session shortly after that and told me how he cried throughout the film, because it reminded him of the closeness that he had with his father, and of course of the loss of his father. And as he opened up in this way, he began to talk about the shame he experienced as a small child in elementary school, particularly, where he said, "I just wanted to be a guy. I just wanted, you know, to be accepted by the guys," which is very familiar in the boy culture and the boy code, and how shame becomes, you know, so predominant in that. And so, you know, in the transference and countertransference dynamic, you know, I varied between being a kind of a maternal figure who was sort of flaky and feeling-oriented, and this father figure who could love him and play with him and interact with him, because he remembered actually being able to play ball with his father before his father got sick. The search for this, you know, pre-Oedipal father of interiority became, you know, very, very important for him. Through the treatment again, this, you could say, a paternal imago was being reestablished that could allow him to feel close to his mother and his wife without feeling emasculated, and at the same time being able to recognize his need for connection and maintain these very adaptive phallic qualities that he had. So much of midlife, by the way, is characterized and characterized by a search to reclaim the lost parts of the self, the so-called depressive crisis that Elliot Jacques wrote about, is a crisis that's facilitated by a feeling of losing contact with parts of the self, and often the parts of the self for males at midlife are parts of the self that were renounced or repudiated because they didn't fit into kind of the masculine or so-called masculine code, often the more feminine parts of the self. Although sometimes we see just the opposite for certain men, often in the healing professions, for example, where their more masculine aspects or phallic aspects were renounced in the efforts to be, you know, a good caretaker of others. Mm.
The situation you just mentioned, where Alan was able to feel closer to his mother and his wife in a more three-dimensional, authentic way, you're suggesting, tell me if I hear this right, that he wasn't able to do that because he overcame his Oedipal inhibitions, but in fact he became a more object-related individual. Mm-hmm. And through the experience, the safe experience of the homoerotic transference and countertransference, he was able to find that place in himself and then bring it to his outside relationships. Is that a fair characterization?
That's a fair characterization. And he also was able to bring it to his younger son and
yes,
support his artistic yes. endeavors, love him for who he was as an other. Hmm. One of the things I think of in this is, again, while it often gets described as the feminine within the male, and I think that's fair enough within the kind of binary codes with which we all operate in our culture, it's part of the proto-masculine essence is the capacity to care for an other, and to carry a sense of an other inside. It's part of what led some analysts early in the or in the mid-20th century to write about a paternal instinct, just as there's a maternal instinct. You can watch little boys, for example, play with their puppies, and you see this incredibly nurturing quality and the capacity to be recognizing of the otherness of the puppy in this case.
So, Michael, there is so much more I would eagerly spend time with you talking about, but we can't. But I do want to take a few moments to ask you about you. We all come to where we are for a host of reasons, and something has brought you to this work. And I'm respectful of your privacy, but you said it was okay for me to ask you this. So
sure.
Here I go.
Sure. Well, I can take it up on in two ways that I think would be useful. One of which was my own upbringing. My father, who was a very dear and gentle man, traveled a great deal. He was a salesman, and he was away from home a great deal. So I grew up with a mother, an older sister, who didn't particularly treasure my existence, and a grandmother from Eastern Europe, who shared a bedroom with me. And so you could say there was a lot of the feminine in my world, but there was also a very close connection with my father, even though he would come and go very often. And I was an athletic little boy, as my father had been. And so I was, often in the world of males playing sports and, getting muddy and dirty and hiking and playing with snakes in the hills around our home. So there were both parts of me, but I guess what I took in from my father more than anything was he was the most nurturing of the characters in my life. And there was a receptivity, even though he was a professional boxer early in his life, he was a very nurturing kind of man, and that stuck with me. As I was growing up, I knew there was something about being receptive or sensitive or something like that that didn't always fit in the boy code that I was growing up in, and yet it was part of me. And so I suppose that set me on the course of trying to understand what being male is all about and what masculinity is all about. And by the time I became a psychologist and studied both clinical and social psychology, I got my doctorate, and then eventually went into psychoanalytic training, I had a lot of interest in gender. And of course, it was in the era where feminism was rising. And where did being a male fit into all of this? So as I studied psychoanalysis and began to think a lot about what I was learning, I, as I indicated earlier, I was also struck by this confusion about the receptivity and the kind of the inner space of being a male, not just the outer space of the thrust into the world, which of course was very important, but what about this inner space and how do we think about it and talk about it and how do we see it in our clinical work with men? And the very first patient I treated before I knew anything about psychotherapy, let alone psychoanalysis, was a male who was at the counseling center of my graduate school, who was struggling with his sense of masculinity. He was a gay man, and he was a very kind of intelligent, sensitive, ambitious, and successful man in his own way, but he didn't feel like he was good enough. And I just listened. And by listening, he felt held in some way, and something seemed to change. So he eventually became president of the gay student union, the first one at the university. And it was like an education for me and sort of set me on the course to further intellectually understand and then clinically work with all these aspects of maleness and masculinity.
The power, I imagine, of your becoming very important to him.
Yeah, I hope. Well, in some way, he was to me.
I have learned so much from carefully studying your book. I do recommend it. Masculinity and Its Discontents, The Male Psyche and the Inherent Tensions of Maturing Manhood. You speak about the capacity to care for another, which is the essence of the genital phase. Your work, your carefulness, your courage, because a lot of what you say, it seems to me, takes courage, because it does go against a number of currents in psychoanalysis and in the political world. And you do it quietly and elegantly and with careful thought. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful for having had the opportunity to read your work and to spend this time with you to get to know you. And I'm sure our listeners will feel their version of the same thing. So I want to thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Harvey. It's a pleasure to talk with you and also to feel your interest and knowledge about the kind of work I do.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.